Welcome to episode 188 of Behind the Shield podcast. My name is James Gearing, and this week I'm very excited to bring to you Cameron Gardner. And Cameron is a battalion chief in Paterson, New Jersey, and also a co-founder of East West Nutrition and East West Speed Strength and Conditioning. We met a little while ago and realized that we had a very similar path when it came to fitness, when it came to the fire service. So we started talking and realized that he'd be a good person to bring onto the show as well. And we ended up discussing a whole spectrum of things, from his time as a bobsleigh athlete to his department's response to 9/11. We talk about the 24/72 shift that's actually very, very popular in New Jersey. So a whole host of topics here. Very, very interesting conversation, a very different perspective. So as I always say before we start the show, please go to your podcast app, whether it's iTunes, Stitcher, whatever you use, rate the show, leave feedback. I love seeing the feedback that you guys leave. Thank you so much for that. But most importantly, as I say every single week, you are the extension of this project. So the more you share, the more you talk about different episodes, the more this podcast grows, which in turn then becomes even more accessible for other people. So use your social media, share these episodes, and help me grow the show to the point where everyone knows where to go to find all the information on the mental wellness, on the physical wellness, and for inspiration as well. So with that being said, I introduce to you Cameron Gardner. Enjoy. All right, well, Cameron, I just want to start by saying thank you so much. Firstly, for lunch in California.
That's right, yeah.
And then secondly, for sitting down with me. So very first question, geographically, where are we finding you today?
Today I'm in Montclair, New Jersey, which is just outside of New York City.
Okay, and are you from there originally?
I'm from close by, yeah.
All right, so if you wouldn't mind, what was your family unit like? What do your parents do and how many siblings did you have?
Yeah, so I was the only child. My father was a industrial designer. He also was like in construction management. And my mother was an executive assistant. My father and mother split up when I was pretty young. I was about four. So my mother probably did the bulk of raising me.
Okay, right. And then did you have any military or first responders in your extended family?
So my mother's brother, my uncle, actually was the one that got me into the fire service. He was a firefighter.
Right. And how, where did he work?
He worked in the same department, actually. So that's Paterson Fire Department in Paterson, New Jersey.
Oh, that's how you got the job.
Yes.
All right. We will explore that in a minute. Now, obviously, we're going to talk about your work on the side of fitness and nutrition. When you were young, were you a sportsman then?
Yes, I was always an athletic kid, was enrolled in all the seasonal sports, baseball, football, basketball, you name it, also track, and then kind of continued that throughout high school and actually even into college and then after.
All right, well, I'm going to jump way ahead chronologically, but it's I think it's a good segue. How did you get into bobsleigh racing?
So that was an accident. I started to sprint. Actually do like track meets, 60 meter, 100 meter, 200 meter races pretty late. I was about 23 years old. When I was sprinting, I met a Jamaican sprinter who was wearing a bobsled jacket. And I said, oh, you know, are you on the bobsled team? And he said, yeah. He said, lots of sprinters bobsled. I said, no way. He said, yeah. He goes, you know, check it out. So fast forward about maybe 5 or 8 years later, I ran into another strength coach who also was on the bobsled team. And I started asking him some questions. And then, what's the criteria? How do you do it? So he mentioned to me about, checking out their website. And that's what I did. And then I sent a talk to the coach. He said, send us an athletic resume. And I guess about 6 months later, they invited me out to a summer kind of training camp.
Oh, amazing. That wasn't the same member of the team from the movie Cool Runnings, was it, by chance?
It wasn't.
No. So you weren't there practicing in a bathtub with him?
No. Yeah.
All right. Well, then back to your earlier years. So what was your, when you were young, what were your career aspirations then? Was it always the fire department or was it something different?
No, it was, you know, another kind of funny set of circumstances. I actually wanted to be a chiropractor. In high school, I hurt my neck, and then my mother took me to a chiropractor, and within an hour, she fixed it. So I was like, what is this that you're doing? You know, I want to do this. And so from that point on, I actually spent some of my time after school and high school shadowing her and, you know, seeing what she does, what's a chiropractor do, you know, day to day. And that was kind of the plan coming out of high school, was to be a chiropractor.
Do you still have good faith in the world of chiropractic now?
So my feeling on it has changed quite a bit. You know, it started to shift gears in my early 20s. I started to see, you know, in a overload of chiropractors in the area, a lot of them were like, you know, kind of hurting for patients. And it started to get a little bit of a, you know, a little bit of a negative connotation. A lot of them were like, you know, just like back crackers or insurance, you know, trying to get insurance payouts from accidents and stuff. So my feelings on it changed a lot. I mean, there are definitely some good ones out there doing the right thing and genuine healers. But I think, you know, you have to kind of sort through the mess to get to them.
Right. Now, because I have a theory on this, how do you advise someone as to how to find a good chiropractor?
Huh, that's a good one. So I think my belief is that the concept of like spinal alignment and then everything should be in alignment is actually like skewed and flawed. You know, I think that's an erroneous assumption. There are so many, you know, biomechanical and individual nuances to our bodies. And sometimes putting them in quote unquote alignment will actually do you more disservice. I also think, you know, that concept, if you're saying it's true for humans, you would almost say it's true for animals, you know, that animals, if we constantly need to be realigned, then animals constantly need to be realigned, which I just think is just flawed thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the outlook I've had from the good ones and the bad ones, speaking of animals, my dog barking in the background, is, it's the chiropractors that do the therapy along with it that seem to have the good results. And I found that myself. I went to some good ones and one particularly shit one. But yeah, if you're just constantly putting back a subluxation because of muscle imbalance, it's just going to keep popping back in.
Exactly.
But if you have that balance as an animal will, then you're not going to need to keep getting corrected.
Exactly, yeah.
Right. Okay. So chiropractic, what took you towards the fire service?
So while I was in college, trying to do my pre-chiropractic, which is essentially just a bio major, I didn't really have great guidance counselors. So I overloaded myself one semester with four sciences along with labs, which was about 16 credits. And it was like way too much work. So I found myself struggling in a couple courses. My uncle, who was a firefighter, you know, he said, hey, you know, you really need to have a backup plan. If college doesn't work out and this isn't for you, what are you going to do? So he really encouraged me to apply for the firefighter exam. And that's kind of what I did. I took the test and I did very well. And, you know, was hired more or less right away. So I figured, you know what, if I want to be a chiropractor, I can kind of do it after. I could always go back to school, but I didn't want to pass this opportunity up. So I entered the career really, you know, kind of not knowing what I was getting into. But I trusted my uncle and, you know, his advice on, you know, it being a great career and a good job.
Right. And that was Patterson?
That was Patterson, yeah.
Okay. So then when there you are, a pretty high level athlete, when you entered, what were the fitness requirements and standards in your particular orientation group?
We took a physical course, which at the time was it was a sprint. It was how fast you could do it. So it was a kind of a job based course. You had to drag a dummy, carry a ladder, advance a hose line, but it was all done in the fastest time possible. So you were allowed to sprint station to station. And really, at the end of the day, you were scored exactly based on your time. The written was only a pass fail. So the fastest guy placed one on the list and therefore was hired first and so on. So.
Right. And if you were on track to be a bobsleigh sprinter, then you'd probably do pretty well.
Exactly.
Okay. So then, you enter the fire service. When you got in there, because I'm always intrigued by everyone's perspective, what was, in Patterson specifically, what was the kind of general fitness and physical ability level like?
So my first day, I showed up with a cooler full of protein and a jug of protein powder, and I got my ass ripped. They laughed at me. They were like, "What are you doing?" As I walked into a cigarette smoke-filled kitchen, and you know, these guys just never saw anything like this. So, without a doubt, you know, I was a maverick in the fire service, where I was the first one to show up in Patterson with a protein jug and having my own meals packed and kind of ready to go. So there were a lot of unhealthy guys. It was very old school. A lot of the manpower were older gentlemen. It was one of those deals where, like, once you were in until you're 65 and you had to leave. You know, guys did 40 years, 38 years, 35 years. No one was leaving. It was the best job around. No one wanted to go until they were forced out. So, a lot of these guys weren't in shape. They were, smoking, not taking care of themselves, lots of years of good firehouse eating. Fitness really wasn't, encouraged, and no one really participated in it.
Okay. And then for you, meal prepping way back then, how did you get around or how did you integrate into the firehouse meals?
So I got my jug of protein hidden on me a lot. played hot and cold looking for my protein jug many days, many shifts. Tried to teach the guys a little bit about, clean eating and what was healthy. Some guys, were interested, some guys weren't. I tried to be included in the meals as much as possible, or if they were making fried chicken, I'd maybe bake it. So, I still tried to be a part of the team, but wherever I was, able to, make the meal a little bit cleaner, a little bit healthier, I would. So that it worked out.
Right. And did you start to take it upon yourself to try and impact the physical side as well?
Yeah, I had, when I first came on my company, I had another couple of young guys. So they were, they were conscientious and, listening. So we had a little bit of we had some workout time, the whole crew in the back where there was a weight bench and some weights. So whenever I could, we go back there and I'd get them to work out and show them a couple things, and some of it stuck and some of the guys stayed with it and some didn't, or they were, hot and cold, but yeah.
All right. And then what kind of, exercise philosophy were you using then? Because I know you've done, bobsleigh, you've done bodybuilding, you've been through all these different arenas. What was the one that you were bringing to the fire service?
At the time, I was into almost like strictly bodybuilding. That was, we're talking, 1996. So I kind of hadn't really gotten into sprinting or bobsledding yet. So I was strictly just kind of like, your typical gym bodybuilder. So we did, normal bodybuilding type activities, bench press, dumbbell work, and then sets and reps that would be, typical bodybuilding hypertrophy stuff you'd see. Not a whole lot of cardio. We did do some sprints here and there, but that was kind of it.
Okay. And then how has that changed the last, couple of decades?
Yeah, it totally has. I think probably the most commercialized, fitness thing you can do that's maybe, that's applicable to the fire service would be CrossFit, of course. So, the guys that are, really into staying fit, a lot of them are doing CrossFit, or at least doing some combination of weight training and either, interval or cardiovascular training. It's just, way more applicable to the actual work.
Yeah. And I know that you got into strongman. So tell me about that, because I know that that pertains very well to the fire service too, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a good point. When I first got into strongman, it was really hard to find the implements. Usually it was a bunch of homemade stuff that somebody had, or there was only one guy in the state that had it. So you had to drive 2 hours on a Saturday to go work out with a small group of, misfits doing this kind of cult sport. I was caught a few times behind the firehouse, dragging tires and sleds and things like that, or swinging an axe. Many things you do, this, awkward carry type stuff in strongman, is without a doubt applicable to firefighting. I mean, if you're dragging hose lines, you're dragging a victim, you're helping your fellow firefighter up ladders, down ladders, carrying tools. So a lot of it is absolutely applicable. A lot of strongman training is applicable to the fire service. Just that awkward, awkwardness of carrying things without getting hurt, you know. And then, as you know, everyone's always straining their back in the fire service, pulling hose and stuff like that. So,
yeah. I think there's two philosophies I think that a lot of people miss, and even in CrossFit, which is why I try and kind of merge strongman and CrossFit together when I do my own personal training. People don't have handles, which is a huge thing. You know, yes, our hose and ladders and all those are pretty easy to grab, but the actual people, whether it's fellow firefighters or victims. But the other thing is the underestimation of the weight of things that we have to move. And you know, there's people will set up training with these dummies and, you know, you're dragging them around. You realize the dummies are like 120 pounds, maybe, you know, and then you see your average person, they are not 120 pounds.
Right.
So I think that's where the strongman comes in, is it really forces you to deal with some, as you said, awkward, but also just heavy weight, and there's no way around it.
No, not at all. And then with the, EMS, the stretchers, you know, heavy carries and stuff. I mean, that's a perfect example.
Yeah. And even the blooming equipment, I mean, it's got a handle, but the Life Pack 15 got heavier, not lighter. Yes. So yeah, that thing's a beast now. All right. So flipping on the other side then, you know, like you said, you were prepping and the guys were eating traditional firehouse meals when you first came in. Now, a couple of decades ahead now, what are the nutritional advice, or what is the nutritional advice that you give the guys in the firehouse these days?
It's the same stuff, clean eating, whole foods. You know, we try to, get adequate vegetables. You want to do a little bit less fat. I mean, you still have a spectrum of personalities. A lot more people now are at least having protein shakes. You know, it's not frowned upon. You're not the oddball. I would say, half of the department probably, uses some form of like supplementation or like a protein shake. And then, of course, like what you hear most from the guys is that, the worst meal of the week I have is here at the firehouse. So, and then, like they're eating healthy all the time at home. I think there might be some truth to it. You know, I think there's kind of a little bit of that mob mentality where, if guys wants to, have a kind of a cheat meal dinner, everyone's like, oh yeah, let's do it. You know, it's kind of that mob mentality. I always try to steer the meals in like a healthier direction. And, I think, the guys know it. I get my balls busted a little bit about it, but I win some, I lose some, but I think for the most part, most of the department has made a shift to healthier eating and just being more cognizant of their health overall.
Right. And do you have a wellness department in Patterson?
We don't. We did have we have an on and off again wellness committee that did some that helped out with some like equipment purchasing, and we did do some like biometric screenings and stuff, and some overall physical wellness screenings.
And was it effective when it was on, you think?
I think it's like with anything, it started with a lot of momentum, and by the time it got implemented and it was kind of left up to the membership to kind of say, hey, listen, all right, here's all the stuff, now go work out. I think some were in, some were out. It's kind of like New Year's resolutions. Everyone kind of got excited, they did it for about a month, and a good portion of them dropped off.
Yeah. And what's your perspective on a wellness department? What would it look like if you had the budget and you could actually implement whatever you wanted?
Wow. I think having like a great doctor on staff, or at least, having him consult, regularly, having, maybe some of the guys, either duly trained as like nutritionists or dietitians, or even as strength coaches and trainers. I think that's kind of, where you need to start off with, set up some kind of a department-wide program, and then allocate some time during the day, for training. And, it's not enforced by us. I don't think they can enforce it up by us legally, but, at least having, all the signals pointing in the right direction and making it really, kind of a favorable environment to kind of, participate in some kind of physical activity or wellness, while you're on shift.
Yeah. And you come against that a lot with the whole mandatory requirements, and it's pretty sad, really, to me. I mean, everyone's got their own opinion, but if it's a job where you're a tactical athlete and you're required to perform in a physical way, you should have no resistance when it comes to being asked to meet a specific bar. You know, what's your opinion on like a national, you know, test, physical test for first responders in general?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like, you know, hey, listen, if you're having like heart surgery, you know, do you want your doctor to be, you know, mentally out of shape where he's either, you know, working on 2 hours sleep? And I know this occurs, but I mean, if you think about it, it's no different than, you know, firemen or police officers being like way out of shape, like, you know, not capable of performing their best. It's the equivalent of like a, you know, some kind of a surgeon being, you know, incapable of performing his best. So yeah, I think there should be, you know, some kind of a standard, you know, some kind of a, some benchmarks, you know, just to kind of get those outliers. Sometimes you have these guys that, you know, might not be, they may be more of a detriment than even helpful, you know, and you're worried more about, you know, a guy that's out of shape on your crew. You know, he might have a heart attack, or he can't even carry his own weight. So, yeah, you know, you need to have, I think, some kind of a minimum standard, you know, and then maybe even, you know, this is like, you know, a lofty goal, but having even like kind of like stipends or even, you know, bonuses for, you know, extremely fit people, or, you know, or like a higher standards in physical prowess.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you said the word minimum standards. That's exactly what they call our training. You know, that's what's so crazy, is people act all shocked 20 yeah. years into the career that you expect them to be able to climb X amount of stairs with the gear. And it's like, well, that was, you were told that was the absolute bare minimum when you entered this profession, that the goal should be that you should be a lot, you know, fitter and stronger and more capable 20 years in.
Yeah, totally.
Right. Well, you mentioned sleep, and that's something I wanted to pick your brain in. I forget because our little conversation that we had a while ago now was, you know, a few months, but
yep.
What's your shift cycle where you are?
So we work 24 hours on, and then we're 72 hours off. Okay. And that's all year.
That's what I thought. Yeah. So, if you recall our conversation, so many of the departments in the country are on 24/48, and
right.
some of them might have a Kelly day every 3 weeks, every 6 weeks. Do you have any neighboring departments that have a longer work week than that?
No, for the most part, I believe almost every department in our state is the same. So all 24/72.
Okay. Because when you address that, I mean, literally, like the rest of the country doesn't have it. It's like you're the fairy princess from Disney. You're like, imagine right. a world with 42-hour week. And it's like, well, there's places all over the country that are doing it, and it's not a shock to them at all. What's your kind of take on, you know, imagine working an extra 16 hours every single week?
Yeah, that's just, you know, as it is now, you know, you get pretty beat up after a 24-hour shift, and it's like you almost need a day to recover. And the whole reason why we moved to the 24/72 was to, you know, prevent sick time, you know, or people that got sick or injured. We used to do, I guess it was 10 and 14s. And what happened was, if you were sick or injured your first shift, you automatically would probably be out for your next shift. Whereas now, if you get injured or if you're sick, you have 3 days off to recover. So it's, you know, you can easily see how that can cut down on sick time, overtime, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it's, you know, it's a win-win. You know, it's win for you know, the city and the taxpayers. And I think it's a, you know, it's a win for the actual firefighters. So
absolutely. And how many years ago did you switch?
I think it was. It might have been around 93, 94, I think, that we switched.
Okay. All right. And so that was before you got there?
Yeah, exactly. It was about, okay. I think, 2 years before I was hired.
Gotcha. Because, you know, what's crazy is, you know, there's this talk, and I love seeing the dialogue now. The whole sleep deprivation is starting to get some, you know, some real grounding in yeah. our profession. And yeah. there's conversations, but then they start getting steered to, with the 56-hour people, oh, the 48, you know, 96, for example. And it's like, no. And I use this analogy, and I forgive anyone that's heard this 1,000 times on this uh-huh. podcast, but the work week is like a Rubik's Cube. And you can spin that damn thing and change all the colors, but it's still a 56-hour work week. And the only way that we're going to improve our health is to make that entire cube smaller, which is, you know, the 42. I don't think anything less than the 24/72 is needed, especially not for now, but that extra entire 24-hour period,
right,
I think is the missing link to truly recovering from getting your ass handed to you for 24 hours.
Yeah. I mean, even with our, you know, with the 24/72, I completely see, you know, adrenal dysfunction, you know, adrenal fatigue, if you want to call it that, you know, low testosterone, you know, cognitive, you know, impairment. So it's, you know, even with our shift now, you know, you're still getting some degree of this, like this, you know, dysfunction in the body.
Yeah. Yeah. And then do you see that with a lot of your colleagues, that they have the low testosterone and some of the symptoms that we see in the rest of the country?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it takes some time to kind of really manifest, like maybe 10 years. But, you know, I think for the most part, you know, even I dealt with it. You know, I had some adrenal fatigue going on maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And, you know, it was really alien to me. I didn't know why I was so tired all the time. But, you know, once I was able to kind of address it and do some, you know, stress management stuff and work on, you know, supporting my adrenals and lowering the stimulants and stuff, I started feeling better. But absolutely, you know, a lot of the guys complain about low testosterone. They're diagnosed with the wellness exam as having low T. And really, you know, it's not so much a biological dysfunction, but it's a product of, you know, work environment, you know, and the shift work.
Yeah. And it's interesting you say 10 years, because definitely in the departments around me, they're all 56 pretty much. And it's not even close to 10 years. We're talking 1-2 years into the career if they're in a busy station. And that's just insane, because, I mean, you're, you know, not even 10% through your career yet and you're already suffering.
Right, right.
Yeah. Very interesting perspective. Well, thank you for that.
Yeah.
So in your bio you sent me, you talked about some rescues. So I would love to hear kind of some of the backstories to some of those career saves that you had.
Well, one of the interesting ones was, so I was in a rescue company for approximately the first 8 years I was on. We actually ran a dual engine and rescue in the same house. So if it was a fire call, you'd take the engine. If it was a rescue call, you'd take the rescue. So we had some flooding going on, and we have a river that runs through our city. And there was a report of a person in the river. So we ended up launching a boat. And while we were in the river, our engine stalled. And while trying to get it restarted, we ended up kind of getting pinned between a broken tree limb and the underside of a bridge. While we were trying to restart the motor, the current was pretty rough, and our operator ended up falling out of the boat. So what we did was I had the idea to, luckily for him, when he fell out, there happened to be a giant tree branch there as well. So I yelled to him, you know, to grab the branch. He turned around and was able to grab the branch. So he's holding on to the branch. And what I decided was that we got to get out from under this bridge and kind of float down to him. So luckily we let go. The current carried us right towards him. And, you know, I just screamed to him, you know, like, hey, you know, get ready, grab onto the boat. So we grabbed onto him, and, you know, we ended up pulling him in the boat. It took us about 50 yards of floating downstream before we kind of got him in. But we were able to kind of get him in the boat. We floated downstream a little bit, and then we were able to restart the boat and, you know, get out of there. So, you know, It seemed much more dramatic in person. We had, you know, the high current and stuff, but, you know, and he was an older firefighter. He was in the military, so he had some, you know, some swift water training as well. So he was able to help in, you know, his rescue.
Brilliant. And then we're talking of rescues. You mentioned when we talked before, being in New Jersey, that you actually responded during 9/11 as well. So you able to kind of tell us that story?
Sure. You know, 9/11, I actually happened to be en route. I was off duty. I was en route to the city to attend college fire science classes. And, I actually passed by, you know, where I saw the plane hit, the first plane hit. I continued, you know, no one knew really what was happening. So I continued up to school, and while in college, you know, we started getting more, you know, bits and pieces of information that, you know, hey, you know, we're under attack. So I took off, I got out of there, I ended up driving back to our department, and at this time, you know, they decided to start sending guys over. We were sent over in a sheriff's department, police convoy to Liberty State Park in New Jersey, which is on the Hudson River, right across from the World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan. As we pulled up, you know, there were hundreds of ambulances that were, called already, to help with mutual aid. They were all set up on this, in this giant park. So it was kind of eerie. And of course, you saw the huge smoke cloud over the city, you know, the two buildings had already fallen. We took a police boat over and, you know, we landed on lower Manhattan, and there was about, 2 inches of, soot, concrete dust really. And it seemed exactly like when you get a massive snowstorm and there's that kind of quiet in the air and, your footsteps are soft. So we were, we all had masks. We were giving out little construction masks on the boat, and that's kind of all we had. There was kind of some makeshift crews over there. Some guys had gotten there earlier from smaller departments across the river in New Jersey. And we ended up making contact with a battalion chief from New York City. He was one of the survivors at the time. He was probably, the highest in command. And he was in charge of the South area, below the South Tower. And what they did was the next building south of that was the Windsor Hotel, which was still on fire as collateral damage. And they needed to put the fire out. It was about 25-story building. So our department, Patterson, was put in charge of laying hose line from Marine One. There was no water supply system in lower Manhattan. It was knocked out. So we set supply lines from Marine One, which was the fire boat in the Hudson River. And we had to lay, we laid hose for hours, probably five blocks worth of hose, multiple lines into the building adjacent to the Windsor Hotel, which was the Marriott Hotel. And what we did was we supplied the standpipe in the Marriott in an effort to get some water out the, 20th floor into the Windsor Hotel. There was just no apparatus down there. There were no ladder pipes. There was really nothing. So we kind of had to use what we got. So, our job was just to, get established water supply in that area and kind of contain the fire. It took us most of the afternoon. The fire still burned. We were there when, building 11 collapsed, which was the late afternoon. You saw a lot of, a lot of stragglers, a lot of, civilians just wandering around aimlessly, really not sure, what to do, where to go. There was, one of the interesting things I tell was, there was a piece of landing gear between two buildings about four blocks down. So it must have actually fallen from above the building straight down, as opposed to like going down and making a turn on the street. So that was kind of shocking to see that in the middle of the street. And then, as you heard some of the stories, there really wasn't a lot of, there wasn't really bodies or anything. Everything was just kind of like dust. So, here and there you might've seen a couple of, limbs or things like that. But for the most part, there was just nothing. We never worked on the pile that day. We just, ended up, just trying to extinguish the fire in the Windsor Hotel. We ended up, our particular crew stayed till maybe 2-3 in the morning on that first day. And then we ended up getting relieved by another crew from our city. What ended up happening was we were one of the first departments in New Jersey to get a LDH, large diameter hose. So being that water was such an issue, we actually had our engine 5 apparatus go over into Manhattan and use their LDH to, help produce a water supply in that area. So I believe our apparatus was there for a few weeks before we got it back.
Wow, you were just flowing water through the window of one hotel into the other building?
Yeah, they had multiple lines, but obviously it was, it's like pissing in the wind. There wasn't enough water to do much to that fire. It was the building, I believe, the Windsor Hotel was under construction as it was already. So, it was just fire for the most part. I think it was through maybe 5-6 floors. So, it was more about containment than really making an offensive attack on it.
Right. Okay. And then obviously we're hearing a lot now about the knock-on effects of of just working the pile, working that area with the cancers and, you know, these other ailments that we're seeing. Did that affect any of your guys?
No, nothing yet. You know, I was, you know, kind of being a health nut. I did the best I could to, you know, wear my mask. You know, it was a little flimsy construction mask. I mean, something you find at Home Depot. Actually, I had two of them. I doubled up. And I wore it, you know, as long as I could from the time we got there till the time we left. You know, there was definitely a lot of crap in the air, a lot of soot, you know, it was all over us. And, you know, the message we got was that, you know, the air was fine. That's, you know, kind of what, you know, they told everyone. I know, you know, our crews were all included in the, you know, the 9/11 Responders Act. So, you know, God forbid anything should occur down the road, you know, conceivably we should be, you know, covered or helped, you know, taking care of whatever, you know, whatever the concerns are. But yeah, luckily no one from our department, you know, sustained anything long term yet, as we know.
Yeah. Well, good. Good. And what about mentally? Do you guys kind of involved in the whole peer support side, the mental health side these days?
You know, not for 9/11, you know, if guys, you know, if they're, I'm sure, like anyone else that was there, you know, everyone's dealing with it in their own way. You know, we do have a access to a, you know, critical incident stress debriefing team. But as far as the 9/11 stuff, I don't believe anyone is, you know, is taking advantage of that for that reason or that incident.
Okay. But I mean, aside from that incident, just in general, these in 2019, are they starting to address the mental health challenges of our profession?
Excuse me.
No, you're fine. I mean, both those are good topics.
Yeah. You know, so over the last couple of years, let's just say the last five, you know, when there is a, you know, an emotionally draining call, whether it's, you know, some potential, you know, child involved, it's a child death, you know, real traumatic, you know, dramatic type calls, you know, we do offer assistance. We know we do have that stress debriefing team. Sometimes, you know, we'll pull the firefighter, you know, out of the company. Maybe he'll get sent home, you know, sick, you know, and wait till, you know, he feels ready to come back. So there's definitely, you know, they're cognizant of that. And, you know, they are aware of it. And then of course, you know how the guys are, you know, everyone wants to deal with their own way and suck it up and be tough and continue with work. So.
Yeah. Yeah. The sad thing is though, I mean, that cumulative effect is what we seem to be losing the most people to. We just had two suicides last week alone in this immediate area, Central Florida here. And I don't think either one was attributed to a specific event. It's just, you know, a career of, you know, these calls that we run over and over and over again.
Yeah, it's definitely something that should be addressed on a larger scale, you know, and, you know, you're right. You know, it's not really thought of until you're like a statistic, you know?
No, exactly. Especially if, and you're not even a statistic if you're retired. That's the crazy thing.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. We talked about some of that last time we met.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, let's transition to your very interesting business that you have, East West. And if start by just telling people why it's even named East West, because I love this whole concept that you guys are 2,500 miles apart.
Right. So my best friend from here in New Jersey, Scott Brangle, he moved out to California about 20 years ago. And, you know, we always stayed in touch and, you know, he visits back here. I visit back there. We're still, you know, best friends. And we both had the same interests, very, you know, health conscious, you know, we were workout partners. We chose different career paths, but, you know, we still have a, you know, deep bond with, you know, being physical strength training. You know, we're both strong men. We both sprinted. So we were spending New Year's together with family, and I'm not going to name names, but a drunken relative started saying, "We got West Coast, we got East Coast, we got East Coast, we got West Coast, East Coast, West Coast." So he said, he's like, "Hey, we got to come up with some kind of a gym or something." So I guess fast forward 2-3 years later, we decide to, you know, kind of trademark the name East Coast, West Coast Speed Strength Conditioning. And so we had the name, and then we started working both independently. I worked part-time from the fire department as a strength coach and a trainer. nutritionist, and he did the same thing out in California. And then before long, we started to, you know, create a brand, and we started coaching, you know, athletes and strongmen. And, you know, he began to flourish out there. I began to flourish here. And then about 5 years ago, he opened up his gym out there, East Coast, West Coast. And then I ended up opening one out here in New Jersey, East Coast, West Coast. So that's kind of, you know, the origins of it. And, you know, we visit each other, you know, I go out there quite frequently. He comes back here. You know, we share a lot of the same beliefs and practices. We train, all kinds of athletes. We train strongmen, we train day-to-day people. So just, you know, big love for fitness and, you know, its application in the world. And, you know, we just, we want to spread that message and that word, you know, to people.
Brilliant. And do you have many first responders in your gym?
We have a few. We have more police officers than firefighters. You know, don't ask me why. I probably just because there's more in New Jersey specifically, there are more career police officers than firefighters. There's a lot of volunteer fire departments here in New Jersey. So, you know, unfortunately, you know, more of them should be paid. But yeah, so mostly police officers, but yeah, they're there.
Right. And so with those first responders, what does your training look like for them specifically?
We do, you know, more or less a form of CrossFit. You know, sometimes we call it strength fit. It's a combination of some CrossFit style stuff. It's some strength training. It's some strongman training. So kind of what you were addressing earlier that you were doing, we'll have a couple of days a week where it's a CrossFit style, couple of days a week where it's strength training, maybe with a Metcon at the end. And then we always have at least one day a week where we're doing strongman type training with like awkward object carries and things like that. So
brilliant. Yeah, that sounds very similar to my training. All right. Well, I think we should transition to some closing questions. What do you do to decompress when you're not in the gym?
So I like to, I do some meditation, just, you know, mindfulness meditation. I kind of do it as needed. I don't necessarily do it daily. I actually like to do gratitude lists. That's, you know, there's some studies coming out now, a lot of literature showing, you know, how many different areas of your life it can benefit, you know, stress reduction, lower inflammatory markers, you know, better sleep. So I do those things. I really enjoy hiking. It's something I kind of got into in the last few years. I do some mountaineering. My tribe of East Coast, West Coast people, we ended up climbing Mount Rainier last June, and we all summited, which was really amazing. And what I tell people is, you know, when you've really like climbed a mountain, there's just this feeling you get. It's like it explains why people do that. You know, you always wondered, hey, why would somebody climb a mountain, or why would they do that? Once you do it, you kind of get it, you understand it. So yeah, I really find like hiking allows me to kind of connect more with, you know, the environment, with earth, gets me deep in my thoughts, you know, allows me some mental clarity, some insight, you know, my higher self speaks to me a little bit more. So yeah, all those things.
Brilliant. Yeah. It's kind of meditation in itself. If you're having to get in the zone, if you're climbing that far.
Definitely.
All right. So I'm going to rephrase the question. Yeah. In your entire lifespan, what is the one book that struck you, you know, the most powerfully?
The Alchemist, Paulo Coelho. Yeah, that's a great book.
Which is your favorite firefighter movie?
I guess Backdraft. You know, we watched it when we were in the academy, you know, so, and we ripped it apart. So it's, you know, it's kind of stood the test of time.
They're supposed to be making a second one as we speak.
Oh, really?
I believe so. And this is one of those YouTube scans, but I've been looking on it. I mean, it looks like it's legit, but they haven't started actually filming, but they're in pre-production. So,
wow, that sounds great.
Yeah, we'll see how that turns out.
I wonder who the star is going to be.
Yeah, I don't know. I think, God, what's his name? Billy Baldwin, I think, was back in it, probably as a chief.
Oh, wow.
As a chief now, yeah. So who knows who the young people are going to be. All right. So is there anyone in your career whether it's someone you know or someone you don't know, who became kind of like a mentor to you that you think could impart wisdom to the people listening to this show?
Yes. So early on, when I was in the Fire Academy, we had some kind of visiting instructors, and one in particular was Captain John Duffy. He connected with a lot of the guys. He was very knowledgeable. He made a big impression on me in the academy, so much so that I requested to be assigned to his company, which was the Engine 6 Rescue. Lucky for me, I was granted that, and he became my first captain. And you know, early on, got me learning, reading in the books right away. Within the first month, he's like, "Hey, here's a book. Start reading." So we did a lot of training. He was big into training. We did a lot of rescue stuff, and of course, as a rescue member, you have to be proficient in a lot of different specialties. We did, ropes, extrications. He really made a big impact early on. And I think it set the tone for the rest of my career, how important it is to train and to constantly learn and, not get complacent. And, he's still is an instructor. He's an EMT instructor, and he also teaches at the academy. And, he continued to teach as a battalion chief and also as a deputy. And he's really, he's made an impact to a lot of guys. I'm not the only one. He was definitely a mentor in the fire service, and I'm very grateful for, learning what I could from him in our time together.
Now, what do you think it was that kept him so connected to the job when many men and women, once they promote, start to detach?
He was a working guy, as a captain, he never wanted to give up the hose line. Even as a battalion chief, you may have seen him with a hose line in his hand. I'm not going to confirm that, but he liked to work. He loved the job. He loved the guys. He loved helping people, no matter what it was, if somebody's car broke down, he's the kind of guy that would, pull over and help out. So, I think it was his passion, it was his career. I think his father was a police officer. So he, public service is in his blood.
Brilliant. All right. So then, the very last question then, because we ended up answering all those three from earlier. So where can people find East West online and reach out to you if they want to talk to you?
So there's eastweststrength.com is the website. It's also the Instagram. And then, of course, I have, as a nutritionist, I have an offshoot of that, which is eastwestnutrition.co. And it's also eastwestnutrition on Instagram. They can reach out to me there. Either site works.
Brilliant. All right. Well, Cameron, thank you so much. It's been a great conversation and just a different perspective again. Someone who's had a parallel career as a trainer as well as a firefighter and, a long career. So obviously when you entered, like you said, people were still smoking in the firehouse. And then yes. Also to pick the brains of yet another 2472 and dispel this myth that you are the same, made of the same cloth as unicorns and mermaids, because
exactly,
you'd be blown away how mythical that shift pattern seems. So
thanks for having me. It was great talking and again sharing similar career paths and perspectives.